Good morning. I'm Marianne Barisonic, and you are listening to Between the Covers on KBOO 90.7 FM. Timber Beasts is a murder mystery set in Portland in the early 1900s. It depicts a past that many in the Northwest might want to sugarcoat or forget altogether. Robber barons run the country with an iron fist, and anyone who isn't with them can expect little in the way of civil rights, worker rights, or even simple justice. The author, Susan Stoner, is a longtime activist. Susan, welcome to KBOO.
Oh, thank you very much.
Now, this book is set in 1902 in Portland. Can you give us an idea generally of the political and the economic climate then, and kind of how it parallels what we're looking at now?
In 1902, well, in the early mid-1890s, there had been a very serious depression, and there were a lot of people who had lost their homes, lost their jobs, and were on the road, especially men. The other thing is the robber barons, as you pointed out in your intro, had a grip on everything that was happening. That's when the trusts were really big. As a backlash to that, there arose the progressive movement, and that included people who were consumer rights advocates. It included the temperance movement, of course. It also included labor unions. And Teddy Roosevelt actually kind of rode the tide of the progressive mentality, where they had a momentum for economic justice going, and he kind of captured that. So he came into office, I think, in 1901, and so this takes place in 1902.
So the main character in this book is Sage Adair, and he makes a lot of money from the Klondike gold, and then he returns to Portland to kind of settle some scores. Is he based on a historical figure?
No, he is not. He works for a man named Vincent St. Alban, who is modeled after a historic figure, Vincent St. John, who was known as the saint by workers. He risked his life to save 40 miners in Colorado and later became a founder of the Wobblies, Industrial Workers of the World.
When you say he risked his life to save 40 miners,
he went into a cave that had collapsed and sort of led the rescue effort, and as a consequence lost, I think, his arm.
Oh, okay. So Sage Adair is kind of a double agent, and he's got a hotel where he's catering to very wealthy clients, but he's working for St. Albans, and he's a labor activist?
He is a labor activist. He actually grew up in Appalachian coal fields, and because of his own personal history ended up sort of in a privileged situation. And so what he's doing is sort of exposing to the public eye the doings and the corruption of the rich and lending whatever help he can to the movement for economic justice wherever he can.
But wasn't what the rich were doing, like, really apparent to people?
No, because, of course, they ran the newspapers and controlled the media. And a lot of the sort of free speech fights that went on later on had a lot to do with that, that people just had to get up on soapboxes to tell the truth because they didn't have any other way to get it out.
Literally stand up on a street corner because
yes.
They didn't own the presses and that sort of thing.
Right. Sound familiar?
Yeah. I think there's one part where the wealthy women are getting together and they want to close down the brothels, not knowing that their husbands actually own them.
Yes, that's exactly right. And they passed a law saying that the owners of the buildings had to have the ownership on it, the name of the owners. Well, it turned out that some of their husbands' names would have been on the buildings, and I think that sort of stopped that.
So one of the issues that comes up in the novel is the 1898 Forest Reserve Act. Why was that a source of discontentment? It sounds really nice. Forest Reserve Act, we're going to preserve the forest.
It does sound good, but it was engineered with enough loopholes that the outcome of it was the Pacific Northwest had so many small gypo loggers, little family businesses, and they were doing well. And what it did is it basically made large parts of our forests federally controlled, and they forced out the small loggers and then turned around and sold huge tracts of lands to very large lumber companies, a lot of them out of the Midwest, Minnesota area, who then came in and clear-cut like crazy. And
like,
of course,
Weyerhaeuser.
I won't name names, but yeah, that kind of big corporation ended up running the forest. So it didn't preserve the forest at all. It polluted the water, it clear-cut the forest, and it drove all these families who were making a decent living out of work and onto the streets and into the cities.
And these would have been families who probably were homesteaders. So
yes.
They came here with nothing. They kind of built up a small
business.
Got their
160 acres.
Right,
yep.
Right. And then this forest preservation. So you can see that the beginnings of the antagonism in the rural areas that we even see today between environmentalists and the federal government has its roots all the way back in this Forest Reserve Act.
That's true. I hadn't thought of that, but that is true. I think that's a good point.
So, yeah, you could see where even if it was like two or three generations back, that would be a memory that would stay with people. Okay, so the other source of power at the time was the railroads.
Right.
And maybe you can talk a little bit about how they influenced the political and economic climate, because it's hard for people now. The railroads at this point are so marginal, but at that point, it was an entirely different story.
Yes, railroads were an enormous trust in the very most wealthy people, men, white men in the country, were in fact running the railroads, Harriman, and there's a bunch of others whose names I don't remember, but you would recognize. They drove up the price of transporting goods so high that they basically forced a lot of farmers out of business. And then the farmers also were dumped onto the rails, actually, and a lot of itinerant people started out as farmers, or they were the kids of farmers who there was no future in it anymore. So they had a death grip on transportation in the country, and they were just milking the farmers dry, and that's where the Granges came from. The farmers' Granges were in a reaction to that kind of thing, and the farmers' co-ops that you see in the Midwest.
I'm not sure what a Grange is. I've seen the Grange buildings, and I know there was a Grange movement, but maybe you can...
It was a fraternal movement, and it's like any other one. You know, there was a lot of ethnic ones, too, for Czechs, for all sorts of different people, Germans. And so the farmers all came together, and they realized that collectively they had more power. And then out of that, sometimes they would start cooperative granaries where they would store their grain so they'd get better shipping deals and ship it in bulk rather than each individual farmer and take advantage of some of the economies of scale.
But a lot of this wasn't brought about just by the sheer economics of it. There was a lot of political corruption going on at the time that allowed the railroads to become as all-powerful as they were.
Well, it's kind of like, you know, did the SEC regulate the banking industry? There's a mentality that is present today that was the same back then when the robber barons were taking over, which is more is good, Horatio Alger is good, you know, the whole idea of get what you can and you're going to make the whole country better, the whole trickle-down effect. And so it was a mentality that didn't permit regulation, and of course, They stopped regulation, and although the law was on the books to stop trusts like the railroads or to put some controls on them, it wasn't until Teddy Roosevelt came in, quite a bit of time after the laws were enacted, that he was the first one to actually use the law for the first time, and he used it against the railroads, and he stopped the combine of railroads that Harriman was trying to pull together.
You're listening to Between the Covers. I'm Marianne Barasonic, and my guest is Susan Stoner, and we're talking about her book, Timber Beasts. Let's talk a little bit about that title. What's a timber beast?
Well, it was a derisive term that was applied to the itinerant loggers, but it's in this book, it's a play on words, because loggers are the noble folks, and the big, large corporation is not.
Yeah, but they were basically looked on as kind of like animals.
They were, and they were treated poorly. They had no rights. There wasn't really a union movement until during the First World War, in terms of the loggers getting together and getting some rights.
And the working conditions were absolutely horrendous, weren't they?
They were horrendous, and if you'll remember when they were talking about the swine flu, they were talking about a horrific plague that had swept the United States. Thousands, like I'm thinking maybe 7,000 loggers just in Oregon and Washington died as a result of that because they were so unhealthy and where they lived was so unhealthy and in the lumber camps, which were mobile, tended to be mobile camps. So they were pretty shoddily constructed, and they'd put them on runners or skids, as they called them, and skid them through the forest from one place to another.
Yeah. Well, what's fun about this book is you've got all this great history there, but then you mix it in with this murder mystery. I keep thinking that this would be such a great way to teach history to kids, especially like high school age kids, because you're taking, you know, a story that's going to be engaging, and then you've got all these historical pieces that you put in there.
I tried to make it so that it would go down easy. I didn't want people to feel they were learning history. I want them to realize after they read it, oh my gosh, I know so much more about that time period.
Yeah. And it comes off very well that way. Okay, one of the characters is an African American, and I was kind of surprised at that. Because Oregon had exclusion laws that were part of the Constitution until 1926. So Oregon didn't have slavery per se, but free blacks couldn't come and settle in the Oregon territories either. So how did this group get to be in Portland in like 1902?
I think after the Civil War, the exclusion laws in Portland, I think, may have applied to where people lived. And Portland had a wonderful and vibrant black community where the Memorial Coliseum was, just like the Italians and the Jews had a wonderful, vibrant community where the Portland Center is. We've unfortunately destroyed those ethnic communities. But in this case, the Portland Hotel was going to be the fanciest hotel on the West Coast. They actually imported men from the Carolinas who had worked in exclusive places and brought them, black men, to work in the Portland Hotel so that the travelers would feel they were getting an elegant experience. And so many of those folks were really industrious and really bright, and they would run side businesses, and obviously extremely hardworking. They ran side businesses and became a part of the nucleus of what became Portland's middle-class black community.
So along with the Italian neighborhood, the Jewish neighborhood, the African-American neighborhood, there was also a very big, very ethnically distinct Chinatown.
It wasn't very big, and that was the big problem during this time period, is they restricted where Chinese could live. And they restricted the Chinese that could come. I think during this period, actually, it was hard to get into the United States. The railroad building was done. They didn't need them anymore. The Chinese sort of came out of the rural areas and into the urban areas. And they wouldn't allow them to bring their families or their wives over. So you had tons of single men, Chinese men living, and Portland had a very restrictive thing of where the Chinese could live. It wasn't very many blocks, and they were so overcrowded there that some of them ended up living in basements or what we know as the Portland Underground. And it was also so restrictive that there was a lot of anti-Chinese riots and things like that happening during this time period. So it was a very fearful time for them. And
anti-Chinese riots?
Yeah, it was, you know, it was very strange. Teddy Roosevelt was very pro-black. In fact, he, or African-American, he actually had people, one of his very first guests in the White House was an African-American. But he was very prejudiced against Chinese, as were most people, and they had exclusion laws and were not allowed to come in. So a lot of them had to come in through Mexico. and just smuggle themselves across the desert to get in here.
Makes you wonder why they wanted to come at all.
Gold Mountain opportunity. They would send money home, and their dream, of course, was to buy a small farm and return to their families, wealthy men, live a nice little life of leisure.
Yeah.
A lot of them died here, though.
Yeah. So there's a couple of brothels in your fictional Portland, and apparently there was a whole big red light district in Portland at the time. One of the whorehouses is run by a woman, and she's got pretty good working conditions. And then the other one is in some really horrible conditions, and at the time, I guess it would be called white slavery. So how realistic is this, Faith?
Well, according to historians, there was over 500 houses of prostitution here in Portland at this
500?
Time. 500? 500. We were considered staid and respectable, but there were all these places.
How big was the population as a whole around that time? I mean, I'm just trying to think. Like, we're talking about, like, one house for every, 500 people or something?
No, it was bigger than that. I don't remember. The population grew really, really fast the first part of the 1900s. And I am thinking, and I could be wrong, that it was more closer to 90,000 that lived here. It was quite a few people lived here.
Okay.
A lot of them single men. And
obviously, yeah.
So the cribs, which are the actually a step up from doing it in the alley, prostitution that was also going on or in the back of saloons. The cribs were in the north end, a lot of them. And that was a lot of women were addicted to opium. It was over the counter opium called laudanum. So that was one group.
Okay, so what's a crib?
A crib is you take, instead of having individual rooms, you just had a big open space, and then you just put walls, thin walls, part way up, and then like curtains over the doors, and they would go in there. It'd be
so pretty basic conditions.
Oh, pretty bad. But you know, the description of the crib in there is pretty much what I read existed. With regard to Lucinda's high-class elite whorehouse, she's actually modeled after a woman who was in Spokane, who was beloved by the people that worked for her for the most part, and she catered to the wealthy, and that's what Lucinda in the book does.
And the women who work for her actually kind of have really good working conditions.
Well, there were a lot of women who came west and there was two ways. They came west either to be prostitutes because they could make money out here. There was a lot of farm girls who, you know, for one reason or the other left the farm thinking they were coming to Portland to be a, working as a nursery maid or a maid in a house, got here and found out it had been a lure. Next thing they know, they're being fed alcohol and laudanum and shamed, and then they can't go home, and then they end up working as prostitutes. Some of them ended up finding men, marrying, moving away, and raising families.
But so it was a combination then of women who did it voluntarily and women who were forced into it by basic circumstances.
Yes.
So the other interesting group is the Flying Squadron. They're riding the rails, and maybe you can tell us a little bit about who they were and who you based them on.
Okay. I sort of messed with the historical timelines on that. The Flying Squadron didn't come into an existence probably until after 1905. But I made them come in existence earlier, just like I have Vincent St. Alban acting earlier than he would have and doing what he probably didn't do but would have liked to have done. But the Flying Squadron was a group of men who, in order to counteract what the railroads were doing, the railroads were really pretty evil. They hired brutal guards to basically kill and do whatever they wanted to hobos and other people they found riding the rails. And so this group of men got together and began riding the rails, and they would find out who was a vicious railroad bull, and they would teach him a lesson. Now, they wouldn't kill, but what they do is they might beat them up, or they might throw them off the train as it went around a slow curve. They might dump them off the train in their birthday suit. They would do things to sort of say to those railroad bulls, we're watching you, you treat people better.
To hurt them and humiliate them.
Yes. And
because they were murdering people who were riding the rails?
Yes. In fact, the book opens, I won't talk about it, but what happens when the book opens, the first chapter actually is what they were doing, which was a way to kill the people who were didn't ride in the boxcar, but rode underneath on some planks. And that actually happened. William O. Douglas, our former Supreme Court justice, saved a hobo's life because William O. Douglas rode the rails, and he warned him, be careful, the railroad bulls on this line do this particular thing. And the guy heeded him, and it saved his life.
Wow. That seems like a really gutsy, desperate way to ride the rails.
It was, but they were desperate times.
Yeah.
A lot of itinerant people.
So there's so much about the labor movement and kind of the political and economic atmosphere in this book. And this has got to come out of your activism. So you've been involved in Portland, kind of the Portland labor and anti-war scene for a while, haven't you?
Right. I came out of high school here and got involved in the late 60s with the anti-war movement and got involved with the Fry Roofing Strike, and which was the roofers were making $2.50 an hour, and the longshoremen came up, and so we all walked the picket line, and some people got arrested and got their heads beat by the cops, and it was an exciting time for somebody who was young and believing in economic justice.
Yeah, so now your work is through the books.
Well, I'm a general counsel for a labor union, and so I am always striving for economic justice and social justice and fairness in the workplace. And it still is the same struggle. It's why I wrote the book. It's for people, as a gift to people who are trying to make the world a better place socially and economically for others. And it's a sort of look where how far we've really come. Because everything that we think is great about America was not brought by rich white men who managed to consolidate and globalize as they are trying to do now. It was brought by the people who resisted them and who said, wait a minute, compassion and human needs are more important, communities more important.
Well, I thought it was really interesting that when I'm reading this book, it's like there's you don't realize how much of an anti-union, kind of anti-labor bias there is in other books until you read one that's written from a pro-labor perspective.
That's true. And I don't know if you've noticed, but when you watch Hollywood movies, they are so rife with anti-labor stuff because the Teamsters have a pretty good lock on Hollywood and the producers hate them. And so you're always having union people be bad guys. And so it's the same with books.
And we don't even notice this bias because it's so pervasive.
Yeah, and it robs us of our history because it is the union movement, the consumer rights movement, the early environmentalists like John Muir, all these people who got together and said, hey, stop the greed, stop the raping and pillaging of the land and the people's lives, and force through laws that put some brakes on them. And that we're still trying to do the same thing. And it's the regular people that are doing it.
Right. But there's this forgetting that happens.
We're
going through this cycle where starting basically back in the 80s where, Reaganomics came in and deregulation and this whole idea that, no, we don't need these laws anymore. And now we're back with this huge disparity between the rich and the poor, and the ranks of the poor keep growing. And it's almost like a lot of what's in this book set in 1902 could be happening today.
Yes. And I think that there's a moral momentum that's building. And I think that especially I'm so encouraged by the youth today because they're very articulate. And they're willing to fight for economic justice and other things.
Now, this book is the first in a series.
Yes.
And so Sage Adair is this double agent. Is he continuing to be a double agent in the rest of the books?
Yes. Yes. He and his mother and his sidekick Fong Kam Tong.
Okay.
So it's really three of them. They're a group. He doesn't do this on his own. Yes, and the second one's about Shanghai, and it lays out the economics of Shanghai, which go all the way to the top. And the third one is about construction industry and honest corruption and corruption in city government. In October 1902, all these bridges across ravines in Portland started falling down, and there's a reason why. And so it's around that. And then the third book is about Teddy Roosevelt. He came to Portland in 1903, and so it's got him in it.
Okay, so the second one about Shanghaiing, this is the practice of dragging men off to boats against their will once they're out in the middle of the ocean. That's it. They're sailors, whether they wanted to be or not.
Yes.
And that was pretty active in Portland, wasn't it?
Oh, very active in Portland. Portland, Seattle, and San Francisco were all quite seriously into Shanghai.
So a lot of the second book's going to be set in the Shanghai tunnels?
They're described and used in it.
So the book also has this elaborate timber fraud scheme. What was that about?
Well, I don't want to give away the plot, but it actually happened, and the upshot of it was is they got caught, and a U.S. senator went to jail, as did a U.S. district attorney, and a group of other rich men in Oregon went to jail behind it.
And that was part of the political climate that was kind of shaping the way that people were looking at government. You could see why there would be a huge anti-government movement at that time, because all the guys at the top were just making money.
Yes.
And the working conditions for the people who were doing the actual work were just absolutely horrendous. And this does seem so much like what we've got going on today.
There's definitely a slide backwards. You know, it took us 60 years to get the 8-hour workday. And as you know, there's been a real movement to erode that 8-hour workday and make it so that they can work people longer and not have to pay them time and a half.
Yeah.
So you're right. I mean, the parallels are astonishing. And I find it significant that Obama, President Obama, has quoted Teddy Roosevelt more than once. And a lot of people thought that Obama was more like Franklin Delano Roosevelt, but actually it's Teddy Roosevelt that I think is the model. And when Roosevelt came in and he had progressive things he wanted to do, he started...
So are you pretty optimistic then about Obama coming in and...
My jury's still out on that. I don't know if he's going to be able to resist the entrenched forces. I'm optimistic about the citizens and the people.
Okay, well, you've been listening to Between the Covers. I'm Marianne Barasonic. My guest has been Susan Stoner, and we've been talking about her book Timber Beasts, which is the first in a series of historical murder mysteries. Susan, thank you so much. If people want to find this book, where's a good place to go?
Barnes & Noble, Powell, your local bookstore, Mystery by the Books. The Oregon Historical Society carries it, and...
Excellent. Okay. Well, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for inviting me. I appreciate it.